Hello, everybody. This is The Bite Show, and this is George Ann Hughes with Brand New Eyes. We are very blessed to have David Seeloff with us. He is the director of Associates for Scriptural Knowledge, and he does carry on the work of Dr. Ernest L. Martin. And right now, we're going to be continuing the book that we're working on, People That History Forgot. And we're into chapter 15, I believe. Hi, David.
Hi, George Ann. Yeah, it's always great to be with you. And, yeah, we're in chapter 15, and the title of this chapter is The Seleucid Capital Moved West to Antioch. And these are the words of Dr. Ernest Martin. And let's get going here.
Okay.
It was not long after the building of New Babylon that Seleucus made another important decision. Oh, by the way, they're trimming the trees out by me, so there might be a little background noise. Seleucus made another important decision, recognizing that the western part of his kingdom was politically more important than the east. He decided to build a further new city to the west, a city that would be his political capital. This was when the famous city of Antioch was built. And of course, Antioch was famous during the Crusades about 1,000 years later, 1,200 years later. But it wasn't built until the time of the Greek successor kings after Alexander the Great. Anyway, this famous city of Antioch, this was done very soon after the New Babylon had been constructed on the Tigris River. In fact, not satisfied with two new cities, Seleucus went on a building spree. He built more than 30 new cities in the empire that he controlled. One of the most important of these new cities was Antioch, and this new city represents an important link in our present study of Babylonians and other Semites moving into the west, into Syria. And by the way, the city of Antioch is where, the Apostle Paul was converted, outside of Antioch. Indeed, just as old Babylon was left desolate when the Babylonians flocked to Seleucus on the Tigris, there were likewise swarms of people from Mesopotamia moving to Antioch when it became the real capital of the kingdom. He invited thousands of people to come from Mesopotamia to populate Antioch and his other new cities. The Jewish historian Josephus tells us that many of the Jews who were in Mesopotamia flocked to every one of these new western cities. And this is in Antiquities of the Jews, Book 2, Section 3, Paragraph 1, actually, if you use that system. But Jews were not the only ones to move west into this new area of influence. Native Mesopotamians also migrated on a large scale. In fact, the region of western Syria had become so racially Babylonian by the end of the Seleucid rule that Strabo, the geographer in the first century B.C., said the peoples of Mesopotamia and those of Syria were then a homogeneous group. They became the same racial stock with no big differences between them. And this is in Strabo's Geography, Book 1, Section 2, Paragraph 34. And Cumont, in his book, Astrology and Religion, pages 77 to 78, he wrote, "The plains of Mesopotamia and Kyole, Syria, inhabited by kindred races, extended across frontiers, which are not marked out by nature, and relations between the great temples, situated east and west of the Euphrates, continued, even in Roman times, without interruption. Yes, Dr. Martin says, the priesthoods and even the peoples of Mesopotamia and those of Syria near the beginning of our era were of the same general stock, and there can be no doubt about this. Now let's look at Antioch, the new Babylonian capital. When Seleucus built Antioch, he invited some Greek colonists to the city, as well as bringing many Mesopotamian peoples with him as its new inhabitants. The Babylonian priests became the foremost of Antioch's citizens. Antioch became a high Greek, quote, a high Greek civilization mixed with various Eastern elements, and especially with the superstitions of Chaldean astrology. And this is a quote from Smith's Geography, Volume 1, page 143. So it is a simple fact that the Seleucid Empire soon became a Babylonian or a Chaldean one in its religious and societal affairs. It was simply a matter of moving the political and religious centers west of Antioch, or west to Antioch. Cumont says in his book Oriental Religions, in page 251, quote, the Seleucids believed in Chaldean astrology, and the kings of commune, as well as a great number of Syrian cities, had the signs of the zodiac as emblems on their coins. It is certain that this pseudo-science penetrated into those regions, meaning the regions of eastern and western Syria, long before the Hellenistic period. Chaldeanism modified Semitic paganism. End quote. So speaking of Antioch, the Seleucid capital, the religious motives which governed the region, Cumont says again in his other book, Astrology and Religion, pages 80 to 81, quote, there can be no doubt that Babylonian doctrines exercised decisive influence on this gradual metamorphosis and this later phase of Semitic religion. The Seleucid princes of Antioch showed a great deal of deference to the science of the Babylonian clergy, as the Persian Achaemenids had done before them. We find Seleucus Nicator consulting these official soothsayers about the propitious hour for founding Seleucia on the Tigris. The cities of Syria often stamp on their coins certain signs of the zodiac to mark the fact that they stood under their patronage. If the princes and cities of Syria thus acknowledge the authority of astrology, which was the special science of the Chaldeans, we may imagine what was the power of this scientific theology in the temples. We may say that in the age of Alexander, it permeated the whole of Semitic paganism. End quote. In other words, Dr. Martin says, the Syria and the Seleucid Empire were saturated with Chaldean and Babylonian teaching. Its religion and philosophies, while using Greek names and Greek cultural words, were nevertheless thoroughly Babylonian. The temperaments of those people who moved to Antioch and Syria were suited to such a religion. Now let's look at a quote from Cumont, Oriental Religions, page 122. Quote, it was Babylon that retained the intellectual supremacy, even after its political ruin. The powerful sacerdotal caste ruling it did not fall with the independence of the country, and it survived the conquests of Alexander. The researches of Assyriologists have shown that its ancient worship, the worship of Babylon, persisted under the Seleucids, and at the time of Strabo, the Chaldeans still discussed cosmology. and first principles in the rival Orsippa and Orkoe. The ascendancy of that erudite clergy affected all surrounding regions, but more than anywhere else, it affected the Syrians, who were connected with the Eastern Semites by bonds of language and blood, end quote. So what is interesting, even when the capital of the empire moved to Antioch, the Seleucid kings called themselves not only the kings of Antioch and or Syria, but they retained the prestige title, Kings of Babylon. This is according to Bevan, House of Seleucus, Volume 1, page 255. This was intended to show that though the geographical influence had changed in this Western movement, the historical connection had not. The Seleucid kingdom was basically a Babylonian one with a Greek veneer, or better yet, it was a Babylonian kingdom to the core, but it was now using primarily the Greek language and cultural ideas to express its Babylonian principles. So let us now inquire at what happened to the population of the Mesopotamian lands and their economic position after the removal of the capital to Antioch. In both cases, there was continual deterioration in the East. First, many people were attracted to the West because political influence was in that direction. Secondly, in the later years of the Seleucid Empire, the Mesopotamian area became a war zone in the struggles between the Parthians and the Seleucids. Thousands of people who had a natural affinity toward their brethren in the West, and many had relatives there, retreated toward the Mediterranean regions. Also, because of the war zone and the migrations, the irrigation system, which had so wonderfully made Mesopotamia a huge garden in earlier years, well, that system was beginning to waste away to a considerable extent, so that much of the land near the end of the Seleucid rule was reverting to deserts or into impassable swamps. It was only natural that the people looked for and went to the more prosperous areas of the kingdom. The Babylonians moved west. Dr. Cumont explains about this deterioration of Mesopotamia in the two centuries before the time of Jesus. To understand his remark, recall that Babylonians and Chaldeans at this time are the same. So let's look at Cumont, Astrology and Religion, page 41. Quote, Hipparchus saw the ruin of the country, talking about Babylon, the ruin of the country where he was born, where was born the science, talking about astrology, in which he illumined. Invaded by the Parthians about the year 140 BC, recaptured by Antiochus VII in Syria in 130 BC, reconquered soon afterwards by King Phraates, Mesopotamia was terribly ravaged for more than a quarter of a century. Babylon, or Seleucia on the Tigris, sacked and burned in 125 BC, never recovered her former splendor. A progressive decay brought on her a death by slow consumption. Henceforth, it is far from the Chaldeans' native land in Syria, in Egypt, and in the West that we must follow the development of the religious ideas derived from the Chaldea of antiquity. End quote. Yes, the Babylonians of Mesopotamia went into Syria, some into Egypt, and by transplantation, many of them flocked further west. I mean, when you stop to think about it, money flows where money is. And Rome was quite wealthy. So a lot of people wanted to be near that wealth. So the first, back to Dr. Martin's text, the first step from Mesopotamia to the west was, of course, Syria. And it must be remembered that Syria was much more prosperous in Seleucid times than it is now. There were huge farms all over Syria, from the Mediterranean, from the eastern shore of the Mediterranean, eastwards, even beyond Palmyra. A second century B.C. Syrian by the name of Posidonius said in the work Athenaeus, Book 5, Section 195, quote, "All the people of Syria, because of the great plenty which their land afforded, was relieved of any distress regarding the necessities of life." In other words, there was good times there. This western region was absorbing the Mesopotamian population. And what is revealing, the eastern Mesopotamian population was deteriorating and the region was turning into desert at the same rate as Syria in the west was growing in population and prosperity. In fact, by Roman times, Syria was the most populous area in the whole Roman Empire. This is according to Trevor Roper, quote, "The End of Antiquity," that article in The Listener, 1971, page 916.
Boy, and look at Syria now.
Yeah, it's being torn apart.
Yep, it sure is.
And from the most populous area in the whole Roman Empire, while Mesopotamia had dwindled to very diminished proportions. Actually, by the second century of our era, you know, second century AD, when the Roman Empire finally annexed Mesopotamia to its rules, they considered the area so useless to Rome that they withdrew their legions after only a generation of occupation. Hadrian in the second century, conquering the region for Rome, destroyed Seleucia on the Tigris and reduced it to a ghost city. This was the fate of many of the few cities which remained in the region. In actual fact, Mesopotamia, in not many generations, became a desert or a semi-desert region, and by the first century BC, Arabs had replaced the earlier peoples in the south and made up one-third of the country. This is according to the ancient Roman historian Strabo in his Geography, Book 1, Section 2, paragraph 34. Now, the important point for us to realize in this present study is that it was western Syria that absorbed most of the Mesopotamian movements of peoples when the wars and the difficulties were happening. But many of the people did not stop in Syria for very long. We have already shown that by the first century AD, even Rome and Italy, much further west, of course, were now finding themselves deluged by people coming from this very region of Syria. They came into Italy mainly as slaves, captured from the remaining Seleucid realm when it began to deteriorate at the time Rome came into that territory. And when the Roman Empire really began under Augustus, the migration to the west increased. Cumont in Oriental Religions, page 106, says, "Under the empire, the importation of slaves increased. Depopulated Italy needed more and more foreign hands, and Syria furnished a large quota of the forced immigration." Then on page 105, Cumont said, "It is certain that the first worshippers of the Syrian goddess in the Latin world were slaves. During the wars against Antiochus the Great, the Seleucid king, a number of prisoners were sent to Italy to be sold at public auction. And the first appearance in Italy of the Chaldeans has been connected with that event. So after this time, we read of many Chaldeans in Italy, especially around Rome. They first came, however, with the Syrian slaves from the Seleucid Empire. And that empire, as we have seen, was filled with Chaldeans, another name for Babylonians. Another reason why people were taken from Syria and Phoenicia to the west is simply because Syria was an overpopulated country just before our era. Italy, on the other hand, after the Punic Wars of Hannibal, had a great loss of population. Swarms of slaves were brought from Syria to fill up the void in Italy and Sicily. It has been proved that almost every slave in Sicily was from Syria. See the book, The Story of the Nations series on Sicily. These Syrians who were transported to Rome took their Chaldean religions directly with them. They were simply transplanted Mesopotamians. Cumont, in his book Oriental Religions, page 124, says, "The importance which the introduction of the Syrian religions into the Occident has for us consists in the fact that indirectly they brought certain theological doctrines of the Chaldeans with them." Then on page 199 of Oriental Religions, Cumont says, "The Chaldean astrology, of which the Syrian priests were enthusiastic disciples, had furnished them, the Romans, with the elements of a scientific theology." So in process of time, these Easterners finally became the later Romans, as explained in earlier chapters of this book. Babylonian sun worship and the mystery of religion became the official religions of Rome. Cumont in Oriental Religions, page 125, says, "The Syrian religions had spread far and wide in the Occident, ideas conceived on the distant banks of the Euphrates." So yes, the transplanted peoples who came primarily from Syria and Phoenicia in the 2 centuries before the time of Jesus were the primary vehicle which brought pure Babylonianism to the West into the heart of Italy itself. As a matter of fact, the Emperor Aurelian in the 3rd century of our era had so strongly the temperament of a Syrian that he proclaimed the Syrian sun god as the official god of the Romans. This Syrian sun god was even proclaimed as the author of the Roman race. In other words, the new Roman race of which the later Caesars had become representatives. Cumont continues in his book Astrology and Religion, page 133. "This sun worship was the final form which Roman paganism assumed. In 274 AD, the Roman Emperor Aurelian conferred on it official recognition. When on his return from Syria, inspired by what he had seen at the city of Palmyra, he founded a gorgeous temple in honor of Sol Invictus, the invincible sun, served by priests which he had brought with him from Syria, who had precedence even over the members of the ancient Collegium Pontificum, and in the following century, the emperors worshipped the almighty star," meaning the sun, "not only as the patron, but as the author of its race. The invincible sun raised to the supreme position in the divine hierarchy was a peculiar protector of sovereigns and of the empire, and it tends to absorb or subordinate to himself all other divinities," end quote. Now, Cumont says in Oriental Religions, page 124, "The god Bel, whom Aurelian brought from Asia to set up as a protector of his states, was in reality a Babylonian who had emigrated to Palmyra in Syria. And it should be remembered that even the later Roman emperors who had in their midst a primarily a Syrian or Semitic race said that the Babylonian sun god was the author of that Roman race. So what must be understood, as we will later show in this book, is the fact that the western part of the Roman Empire came to be settled by various types of Semitic peoples, and that at one time a particular type would dominate, and at another time others would take over. For example, in the time of the Severide emperors who ruled from 193 to 235 AD, about 100 years before Constantine, they were of Punic origin, although they came from North Africa. They were Phoenician in racial stock, who had originally come to North Africa from the city of Tyre and its vicinity. In the time of the Severide emperors, there were strong ties through marriage with these Punic peoples and those peoples of Syria. The ancestors of the Severide emperors were really from Tyre. And the early histories, as we will show, reveal that many, if not most, of the Tyrians that became Phoenicians were actually of Edomite stock. In other words, they were kin to the Jews through the twin brother of Jacob named Esau. Other Roman emperors and rulers in later times were of different branches of these various Semitic peoples who had moved into the western parts of the Roman Empire. All of these types of Semitic peoples, including, of course, the Samaritans, that came into the West, are part of the people that history forgot. And we will show some of the significance regarding these important divisions of these kindred peoples as we progress in this research. And what this book is attempting to do is to place these so-called lost people within the mainstream of historical understanding, which most scholars can easily recognize from the 7th century onward. These Eastern peoples transformed the society which came to be found in the Roman West. It is important for the understanding of Western civilization that these matters be recognized and comprehended. The history of the peoples of Europe can only be made clear when these points are realized. And so ends chapter 15, the Seleucid capital moved west to Antioch. Should we just go on to chapter 16, George?
Yes, I think so.
Okay. This chapter is titled, Easterners Transform the Roman West. This is a rather short chapter. In this chapter, we will briefly notice the later influence in the Roman Empire of those Syrians who remained in the East. Let us notice those in Syria, Asia Minor, Phoenicia, and adjacent areas, those who were not taken as slaves to the West. It is not too much to say that they played one of the most influential parts in making the empire great. For one thing, the major part of Roman wealth was in the East. At least it was before 70 AD and 135 AD with the wars that the Jews fought with the government of Rome. In the period before the destruction of Jerusalem and Judea, nearly all manufacturing, industry, and culture remained Eastern. The West was predominant only in agriculture and soldiering. The Eastern Syrians, being in the very center of this prosperous region, capitalized on their excellent situation. Manufactured goods and delicacies from the further east were wanted and needed in the west. The Syrians, being the natural heirs to the old Syro-Phoenician trading system, stepped into the shoes of their forefathers and became the giants of commerce throughout the Roman Empire. They practically had a monopoly in the enterprise. These Syrians established many trading colonies in all the Roman world. Every major port had colonies of Levantine Syrians who had ties with their brethren who still remained in the eastern parts of the empire. Remember now, we are not now speaking of the freed Syrians who were making up the general population of Italy and Sicily, who had primarily been taken there as slaves. We're talking about those Syrians who remained in the east of the eastern shore of the Mediterranean Sea. The influence of these trading Syro-Phoenicians cannot be overemphasized. The effect they played on Roman history, particularly in the history of the Middle Ages, was of lasting influence in the history of Western civilization. Let us now observe what scholars say about these Syrian traders who monopolized trade in the Roman world. Dr. Cumont, who was a recognized authority on comparative religions in Rome, gave an excellent and correct rundown. And this is in his Oriental Religions book, pages 107 to 109. It's an extensive quote. At the beginning of our era, the Syrian merchants undertook a veritable colonization of the Latin provinces. The Levantine traffic attained a development previously unknown. We can trace the history of the Syrian establishments in the Latin provinces from the 1st to the 7th century, and recently we have begun to appreciate their economic, social, and religious importance at its true value. The Syrians' love of lucre was proverbial. Active, compliant, and able, frequently a little scrupulous, they knew how to conclude first small deals and then larger ones everywhere. Using the special talents of their race to advantage, they succeeded in establishing themselves on all coasts of the Mediterranean, even in Spain. The Italian ports, where business was especially active, attracted them in great numbers. But they did not confine themselves to the seashore. They penetrated far into the interior of the countries, wherever they hoped to find profitable trade. They followed the commercial highways and traveled up big rivers. By the way of the Danube, they went as far as Pannonia. By the way of the Rhone River, they reached Lyon. In Gaul, they were especially numerous. And as an aside, Dr. Martin says, Dr. Tarn says that southern Gaul and up the Rhone River was especially eastern in race and not Greek or Gallic at all. Continuing on with Cumont, in this new country, meaning Gaul, that had just been opened to commerce, fortunes could be made rapidly. The Syrians traveled over the entire province, still talking about Gaul, as far as Trevia, where they had a strong colony. Not even the barbarian invasions of the 5th century halted their immigration. Saint Jerome describes them traversing the entire Roman world amidst the troubles of invasion, prompted by the lust of gain to defy all dangers. In the barbarian society, the part played by this civilized and city-bred element was even more considerable. Under the Merovingians, in about 591 AD, they had sufficient influence at Paris to have one of their number elected bishop and to gain possession of all ecclesiastical offices. It may be remarked that Syrians also gave the papacy several popes in the 8th century A.D., and in England, even an Archbishop of Canterbury, as an example of their commercial and religious importance. That man was a Syrian. Those establishments, those commercial colonies, exercised a strong influence upon the economic and material life of the Latin provinces, especially in Gaul. As bankers, the Syrians concentrated a large share of the money business in their hands and monopolized the importing of the valuable Levantine commodities, as well as the articles of luxury. Their moral and religious influence was not less considerable. For instance, it has been shown that they furthered the development of monastic life during the Christian period, and that the devotion to the crucifix was introduced into the Occident by them. During the first 5 centuries, Christians felt an unconquerable repugnance to the representation of the Savior of the world nailed to an instrument of punishment, more famous in that time than the guillotine of today. The Syrians were the first to substitute reality in all its pathetic horror for a vague symbolism. Once again, this extended quote was from Cumont, Oriental Religions, pages 107 to 109. Dr. Martin continues. So Dr. Cumont stops in the 8th century A.D. with the story of these commercial peoples. Actually, some of their most important functions came later. For the commercial cities of Venice, Genoa, Pisa, and Marseille, and the banking centers of Italy and France, which in the Middle Ages dominated the whole character of European life, they were the heirs to and descendants of these early Syro-Phoenicians. Even the Crusades were brought about, it has been maintained by some historians, by the wish of these commercial cities to open up again traffic into the East. And actually, the Crusades were motivated more by greed and lucre than by the religious spirit. And by the end of the crusading times, there was some Jewish influence being felt in these commercial cities, along with the Syrians. But still, the Syrians, or rather their descendants, were very active. We have, however, gone too far ahead in the story about the peoples from Syria, and by Syria I mean the whole area of Syria, as well as areas of Phoenicia, Asia Minor, Samaria, and the adjacent regions. Those Chaldeans, Phoenicians, Samaritans, etc., radically changed the racial characteristics and religious ideas of the later Roman world. So that's chapter 16, George Ann.
Wow. This is fascinating information,
Especially
involving Syria.
Well, think about it. Venetian sounds a lot like Phoenician.
Yes.
It?
Yes, it does. Yeah.
So let's go on to chapter 17.
Okay.
This will be the last one. It's, not too long.
Okay.
It's titled Eastern Philosophy Conquers Rome. Once again, Dr. Martin's words. We have seen that the new Romans brought with them Eastern religions, which to the early Latins would have been repugnant to their nature. But there was a race change in Italy. The new race was mainly of Easterners who felt right at home in the old Babylonian sun cults and mystery religions. It is hardly any wonder that Rome went over to the Babylonianism. As Dr. Frank says in his article, Race Mixture in the Roman Empire, page 707, the mystery cults permeated the city, Italy, and the western provinces only to such an extent as the city, Italy, and the provinces were permeated by the stock that had created those religions. Dr. Martin continues, understanding that these new Romans readily accepted those beliefs which appealed to their temperaments, it will pay us to review the philosophies which those Eastern religions accepted. The origin of the later Roman philosophies were directly from the East. They were mainly from Syria. Indeed, the one philosophical belief which gained practically universal approval and acceptance by Roman society in the first and second centuries was the philosophy of Stoicism, the Stoic philosophy. Stoicism was one of the most interesting philosophies that ever came out of the East. It has been compared as the most Christian of all philosophies. Many books have been written endeavoring to show the remarkable parallels between Stoicism and Christianity, especially Roman Catholicism, that aspect of Christianity. There is some definite agreement between Catholicism and this philosophy. The philosophy taught the universal brotherhood of man, the doing away of national barriers, the encouragement of intermarriage, and having one law over all. They called the ideal state, as one governed by a central city, the city of God. When the Roman Empire came along, the Stoic philosophers saw the empire as the ideal physical state, if it were only administered humanly and for the public benefit. Because of this and other reasons, the Stoic philosophy was taught in profusion over the empire, and nowhere was it accepted more and with a type of religious crusading spirit than in Italy. In the first and second centuries, Platonic teachings in their primitive state were not as popular as they had been. The system of Aristotle was not altogether accepted because his teaching was not universal enough. Epicureanism, the only possible rival to Stoicism, was too selfish, anti-religious, and not conducive to universal brotherhood. Only one philosophy suited the Roman temperament in the early empire, and that was Stoicism. It was the one philosophy that did not, in one way or another, repudiate the pagan gods. It agreed that they should definitely be retained for man, for his happiness, and man's need for religion. The Stoic philosophers encouraged to a great degree the teachings of paganism. The religion that the later Stoics promoted was generally the Roman variety, because their utopian city of world rule was Rome. Only by acknowledging Rome could they hope to achieve their universal state. And they gained their world state to a remarkable degree through the empire. It is little wonder why most of the noble Romans accepted the doctrines of Stoicism and not the other philosophies. No philosophy suited the temperaments of the later Romans more than this one of Eastern origination. Now, it's actually surprising that Stoicism was not a Greek creation. And it has often been believed that by most ordinary people that Greece was the home of philosophy. And to a certain extent that is true. Primal philosophies, which the West admired, are basically Grecian in origin, with the exception of Stoicism. Dr. Lightfoot, writing about the two philosophies which gained more adherence after the time of Aristotle, which were Epicureanism and Stoicism, says in his book Philippians, page 273, these two later developments of Greek philosophy took root and grew to maturity in Greek soil. But the seed of the one, Epicureanism, was strictly Hellenic or Greek. The other, meaning Stoicism, was derived from an Eastern stock. Epicurus was a Greek of the Greeks, a child of Athenian parents. Zeno, the founder of Stoicism, on the other hand, was a native of Citium, a Phoenician colony in Crete, and probably of Semitic race, for he is commonly called the Phoenician. Babylon, Tyre, Sidon, Carthage reared some of his most illustrious, his successors. Not a single Stoic of any name was a native of Greece proper. So the Stoic philosophy was foreign to the pure Greek. Not a single important Greek of pure stock joined its ranks. Once again, Lightfoot, in his book Philippians, page 299, quote, "The principal Stoic teachers all came from the East, and therefore their language and thought must in a greater or lesser degree have borne the stamp of their Eastern origin. We advance a step further toward the object of our search. If we remember that the most famous of them, the Stoic philosophers, were not only Eastern, but Semitic Babylonia, Phoenicia, Syria, and Palestine are their homes," end quote. Then he continues on, Lightfoot continues on, in page 310. Quote, "It is not, however, among the Greeks to whom the national temper, to whose national temper the genius of Stoicism was alien, that this school achieved its proudest triumphs. The Romans offered a more congenial sphere for its influence. And again, here, it is worth observing that their principal instructors were almost all Easterners. Poseidonus, for instance, the familiar friend of many famous Romans, was the most influential missionary of Stoic doctrine in Rome itself. He was a native of Syrian Apamea," end quote. The truth is, the Chaldeans could not be outdone in the field of philosophy. When, during the Greek period, the religions of Greece took a back seat to the study of philosophy, and many influential people were abandoning their ancient religious allegiances, the Chaldeans entered the new field by creating a philosophy of their own, a philosophy which would retain the gods, and at the same time be attractive to intellectuals. Stoicism was born. Dr. Cumont says in Astrology and Religion, page 70, "Stoicism readily agreed also with the determination of the Chaldeans, founded as it was upon the regularity of the sidereal movements. Thus it was that this philosophy made remarkable conquests, not only in Syria, but as far as Mesopotamia. I recall only the fact that one of the masters of Stoicism, the successor of Zeno of Tarsus at Athens, was Diogenes of Babylon, and that later on, another distinguished Stoic, Archidamus, founded a famous school at Babylon itself," end quote. Then in Astrology and Religion, pages 81 to 82, Cumont writes, "In the empire of the Seleucids alongside Chaldeanism, Hellenism had established itself in a commanding position. Above the old native beliefs, the doctrines of Stoicism, in particular, exercised dominion over men's minds. It has been often observed that the masters of Stoic school are for the most part Easterns. The leading representatives of these doctrines were all Syrians, and it may be said that Stoicism was a Semitic philosophy." It's almost like the ideas that they had were almost Jewish paganism, similar almost.
Yeah.
continuing with Dr. Martin. And indeed it was. Stoicism was the Babylonian reaction to Greek philosophy. Stoicism was the philosophy designed for the Eastern peoples, who were mainly of Semitic stock, although there were some Persian mixtures. It was the philosophy designed to maintain Chaldeanism in an age which looked like Greek secular philosophy might take the place of religion. And thus, Stoic philosophy was invented to retain Chaldeanism among the intellectuals. And it succeeded remarkably. The whole Roman world virtually succumbed to it, Dr. Cumont says, in Astrology and Religion, page 99. We are struck with the power of this sidereal theology, founded on ancient beliefs of Chaldean astrologers, transformed in the Hellenistic age under the twofold influence of astronomic discoveries and Stoic thought, and promoted after becoming a pantheistic sun worship to rank of official religion of the Roman Empire, end quote. So Babylonian doctrines and religions came to be the official Roman religion. And one of the big helps in bringing it into existence was Stoicism. This was the philosophy that did not ridicule the pagan gods, but felt they were always necessary for the true philosopher. In fact, Stoicism can be said to be the savior of Babylonian paganism among the intellectual classes. Cumont says in Astrology and Religion, page 153, the Chaldeans were the first to conceive the idea of necessity dominating the universe. This is also one of the ruling ideas of the Stoics. On page 69, Cumont says, certain profound affinities reconciled Stoicism with Chaldean doctrines. In the Cambridge Ancient History, it was noted the agreement between Stoicism and Babylonianism. In Cambridge Ancient History, volume 11, page 641. Quote, as early as the Seleucids, Zeno of Citium and many of his chief disciples, such as Diogenes of Babylon and Antipater of Tarsus, had been Easterns. It may well be said that Stoicism was largely a Semitic philosophy, not only in respect to its teachers, but of its doctrines also. Its pantheism, which defies all of the elements of nature, and its acceptance of the fatalism of astrology, side by side with the retention of belief in the active intervention of God in earthly matters, link the porch, or Stoicism, with the Syro-Babylonian temples. Later, there were many Syrians among the leading savants who initiated the Romans into the precepts of the various schools, end quote. So it's clear that Stoicism is Babylonian philosophy. Its teachings and doctrines were accepted with open arms in Italy. The new Romans brought their religion with them, and they were religions which suited their temperaments. They also brought their philosophical beliefs with them. Stoicism made no headway among the secular-minded Greeks, and the ancient Romans would have laughed it to scorn, but the new peoples coming from the East, where Stoicism was created, found this philosophy an ideal one for perpetuating a type of universal or Catholic world religion and society. Lightfoot, in his book Philippians, page 276, says, quote, though the germ of Stoicism was derived from the East, its systematic development and its practical successes were attained by its transplantation into Western soil. In this respect, its career, as it traveled westward, presents a rough but instructive parallel to the progress of the Roman Catholic Christian Church. Actually, Kumant says of the Christian Church, but he meant the Roman Church. The fundamental ideas derived from Eastern parentage were reduced to a system and placed on an intellectual basis by the instrumentality of Greek thought. One of the most famous Stoics of the Roman world was Seneca, a Semite himself. The Roman Catholic fathers called him our Seneca and greatly praised his work, even though he was a firm advocate of paganism. Indeed, most famous Romans were Stoics. Williams, in his Historian's History, Volume 6, page 311, writes, Seneca, Epictetus, Marcus Aurelius, and Plutarch could not think or speak otherwise than as they did because the philanthropic ideas of Stoicism became an integral and essential part of their nature. End quote. Stoicism, thus, was the philosophy of Easterners who became the later Romans. The widespread acceptance of this normally alien philosophy is a strong indication that the Romans who grasped onto it were also the peoples who invented it. As the Syro-Phoenicians and Samaritans progressively migrated westward into Rome and Italy, they simply carried their religious and philosophical beliefs with them. And because those beliefs proved to be far superior to what the people in the West had formerly believed about the old Republican gods and goddesses of Rome, they promoted these Eastern deities to the highest pantheon within the Roman Empire of the 3rd and 4th centuries. These were the pagan rites that Constantine and his successors were imbued with at the time they began to see in Christianity the vehicle with which to preserve and to transform Rome into a new and dynamic state. They were successful. Indeed, there was nothing inferior about these Eastern religions and philosophical beliefs, nor the people who brought with them to the West. They were the very teachings that Constantine and his followers adopted. True, they changed their names and the doctrines which they advocated into names which were derived from the New Testament. In effect, the later emperors retained pagan idolatrous worship, which had come from ancient Babylon, and began to call it the religion of Christianity. Constantine struck coins in honor of Helios, the sun god, long after he claimed to be a Christian. These idolatrous teachings and practices, however, were as different as daylight and dark from those taught by Jesus and his apostles. Of this, there can be no doubt. The primary person who was responsible for establishing the syncretic development of mixing paganism into Christianity, so the New Testament and the early Christian scholars inform us, was Simon Magus. It took about 300 years for the syncretic principles of Simon Magus to make an impact on Orthodox Christianity. But with Constantine the Great, the seeds of the syncretism fell on fertile ground. From then on, idolatry and pagan doctrines and customs began to enter mainline Christianity. An observer during the time of Constantine was the great Christian historian Eusebius. He mentioned that Simon Magus was indeed the originator of all heresy in the Christian community, and that even in his day, there were people who were feigning Christianity, but at the same time were bringing into vogue the use of idolatrous images. note what Eusebius says in his book, Ecclesiastical History, Book 2, Section 13, Paragraphs 5 and 6. Simon was the author of all heresy. From this time down to the present, Eusebius says, those who have followed his heresy have feigned the sober philosophy of the Christians, which is celebrated among all on account of its purity of life. But they, the Simonians, those who followed Simon, have embraced again the superstition of idols, which they seem to have renounced, and they fall down before pictures and images of Simon himself and of the above-mentioned Helena, who was with him. Those are the images of those who, of Jupiter and Minerva, as we showed in previous quotes. And they venture to worship them with incense and sacrifices and libations, end quote. Recall that Eusebius was upset with Constantia, the emperor's sister, that even she had wanted to have pictures and images of Christ and the apostles, but that Eusebius displayed great abhorrence at such a request. He said in his letter to Constantia, such practices are illegal for us. Are not such things, meaning pictures and images, are not such things excluded and banished from all churches all over the world? Eusebius thought such pictures should be destroyed. That's what he was saying. Lest we appear like idol worshippers to carry our God around in an image. End quote. To Eusebius, the use of pictures, images, or icons of Jesus and the apostles by Christians was a forbidden thing, though he admitted that some were beginning to use them. He said that the use of such depictions was like those who followed Simon Magus. Though Eusebius had a watchful eye and said that most followers of Simon were banished from active participation in church services at his time, he nonetheless understood that they were a pestilence, that were still a menace that people should be aware of. Sometimes when I don't take deep enough breaths when I talk, I start yawning. Eusebius continues in his letter to Constantia, Book 2, Section 1, Paragraph 12, quote, and what is more surprising, the same thing, he's talking about faking conversion, is done to this day by those who follow his, talking about Simon Magus, most impure heresy. For they, after the manner of their forefather, slipping into the church, like John said, they would slip into the church, like a pestilential and leprous disease, greatly affecting those into whom they are able to infuse the deadly and terrible poison concealed in themselves. Eusebius could see what was beginning to occur in the Christian church at the time of Constantine, but he took it about 50 years, that it took about 50 years for the tide to be turned from abhorring the use of pictures, images, and icons into their full use in most Orthodox Catholic churches. The very thing that Eusebius, Epiphanius and others decried against and warned people not to adopt such usages became fully acceptable and favored within a short 50 years from the time of Constantine. The teachings of Simon Magus in regard to such things finally prevailed in the Christian churches as a whole. During that 50 years, it became common in a step-by-step manner for Christian authorities to allow the blending of old pagan ways with the teachings of the gospel. The pagan teachings in many cases simply had their names changed from their heathen nomenclature associated with them into new Christian names for the pagan images, pictures, customs, doctrines, etc. It was a blending of religious practices that brought about the Christian church of the 5th century A.D., which was about as far away in teaching from the early teachings of the apostles as one could get. The very principles that Simon Magus and his successors were trying to perform in their time in order to bring in a one-world universal religion were adopted after the time of Constantine in the Christian church by the Christian authorities to bring about the universal church. In this regard, note what Hastings' Dictionary of the Apostolic Church has to say about this matter. Hastings' Dictionary, Volume 2, page 496. Quote, "The amalgam of paganism and Christianity, which was characteristic of Gnosticism, and which was especially obvious in the Simonian system, is readily inexplicable in the teaching of Simon Magus, who, according to the story in Acts, was brought into intimate contact with Christian teaching without becoming a genuine member," end quote. In William Schaff's History of the Church, has a reference to Simon Magus and his blending of paganism with Christian teaching. Schaff, History of the Christian Church, Volume 2, page 566. Quote, "The author or first representative of this baptized heathenism, according to the uniform testimony of Christian antiquity, is Simon Magus, who unquestionably adulterated Christianity with pagan ideas and practices," end quote. So that mainline Christians did not hold out against the philosophies of Simon Magus until the time of Constantine. I'm sorry. Let me reread that sentence. Mainline Christians did hold out against the philosophies of Simon Magus until the time of Constantine. But the 50 years after Constantine saw the doors wide open for the blending of pagan doctrines, customs, images, pictures, etc., with the mainstream teachings of the visible Christian church. And we have been saddled with them ever since. So thank you, Georgianne, for allowing me to do Chapter 17, Eastern Philosophy Conquers Rome.
This is extremely interesting information, David.
Yeah, now many people are familiar with Two Babylons by Hyslop.
Yes.
Which have we dealt with Hyslop yet in this book?
No.
Well, Dr. Martin does refer to it, but this fills in a lot of historical gaps, and Hyslop thinks there's a straight line, but Dr. Martin, I think, makes some very useful and fine distinctions.
Yes.
Between Simon Magus and when it became official within the churches. It was pushing up definitely from the bottom, but in general, the hierarchy, with the doctrine of the Trinity, did actually, push it over the edge, I think, with Constantine's adherence to Christianity. And he was fine with renaming some of those ideas. I had a professor at Fuller Seminary who wrote a book on the philosophies, history of philosophy, and he said that Stoicism was Greek, but he didn't give any references.
Oh my.
And yet he didn't apparently do his due diligence on this.
Wow.
By looking at the racial characteristics of the people who promoted Stoicism.
Wow.
Very interesting.
Very. Extremely interesting. Everybody, you can go to Ask Elm, that's askelm.com, and there are books for free that you can read online, and there are many, many great articles available. And you can contact David Seeloff at this address, david@askelm.com. So, David, thank you very much.
Okay, and let me say that the last two chapters that we're going to do next time are titled The Jewish Holdout Against Idolatry, and Chapter 19, Islam and the People, That History for God.
Oh, interesting.
Both of these will be very interesting to cap off this book.
Islam prohibits or forbids any idols, pictures of Muhammad, anything like that.
Well, originally they did not. They did allow, I don't know if we covered that earlier, but I'm sure we've covered it in other things, other articles. Islam did originally allow animals and humans to be portrayed. It was only later, under the later caliphs, I believe, that it was forbidden. Which most people don't realize and understand. But I think Sir John Glubb talks about that in his book on Islam. And I've heard some Islamic scholars, because I try to go to the Islamic scholarly events here in Portland, and they have addressed that and admitted it. So that it's actually a cultural thing that came later, and it was not a teaching of Muhammad.
Right.
So,
my goodness.
Interesting.
Yeah, it just, what can I say?
And as we're presenting this in, March, 13th, 2013, there's a conclave going on right now to elect a new pope.
Yes.
And most of you probably listening to this will, it's the 12th, most of you listening to this will, the pope will, whoever he will be elected by the time you probably listen to this.
Yeah.
So keep track of that. It's very interesting. These influences are in the Catholic Church today.
Yes.
But I wrote an article which we've presented on modern, how universal, modern concepts of universal salvation. You'll have to look up the exact title. The Catholic Church is turning toward universal salvation as a doctrine, toward the, and also along with that, they would have to abandon the teaching of hell unless they would move to the idea that it's corrective.
Yeah.
In other words, in a sense, you would have salvation by hell, which is not works, but salvation by suffering, which fits into other Catholic theology, penance and suffering and all that stuff for sins that you've done. Apparently Christ's works are not enough. But not only is it the works of the law, but works of penance that get you saved. But universal salvation, I believe, I've come to believe, will be a teaching of the Antichrist. Because that would be very convincing to a lot of people at the time of the end. And that would allow you to kill people and say, well, God, if the Antichrist portrays himself as God, says, I killed them to be resurrected for another day. Those who hold biblical teachings contrary to what the Antichrist is teaching at the present time. You follow that? Yeah.
Oh,
so I am beginning to come to that conclusion, because it's a, in my understanding, a bedrock teaching of in the book of John. It doesn't come out in the other Gospels because they have a different focus. But it's there's nothing to prohibit it. And, of course, in Paul's teachings and elsewhere, even Peter teaches it. So that you have one of the teachings of Christ being that of universal salvation, which would be like Christ to do as part of the deception. So think about that, because that's what we're talking about in this whole book, The People That History Forgot, was they brought their idolatry and their paganism, not just idolatry, but paganism with them. And there's, anytime there's paganism and idolatry, there was always a sexual component. And unfortunately, we see that played out in institutions of the large, great denominations of Christianity throughout history.
Yes. Oh. Well, David, I look forward to our next audio file, and I know the listeners do too.
Great.
So, God bless everybody that's listening. Good night.
Good night.